This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with a representative from Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Jose Vasquez, following in the great tradition of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, is bringing out the truth about what's been done to the Iraqi people and to the American soldiers who have been forced to go over there and fight.
We'll talk with editor and writer Anthony Arnov, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal.
As the U.S. tries to shove the Status of Forces Agreement down the throats of the Iraqis, there's resistance to continued U.S. occupation.
Stay with us.
Well, here we are for some updates, and we're glad to have back in the studio with us our fourth, Dalia Hashad from Amnesty International. And she's been following very closely, as AI has, the case of Troy Davis. We brought you a quick update last week when there was a stay in the circuit, I guess, Dalia?
Yep.
Why don't you just give us a little more of what's going on with Troy Davis right now? He's still around. There's still some time, I guess.
So people will recall that Troy Davis is on death row in the state of Georgia for a murder of police officer Mark McPhail. He was convicted solely on the basis of witness testimony. 9 witnesses testified against him. Since then, 7 of the witnesses who are unconnected to each other have come forward and said that they lied, that they were pressured by police into identifying Troy Davis as the murderer, and really they had no such information. The 2 people who did not come forward, one is the main alternative suspect, and the second is an individual who originally told police that he was not able to identify the shooter and he could not identify Troy Davis as the person who killed the police officer.
So this case has now been through a lot, Dalia. We know that. By this stay that was entered was how many hours before his execution or how many days?
Well, Troy Davis has had 3 stays of execution. This marked the third. Within a day of his execution, then we had within 2 hours of his second scheduled execution. And this happened on a Friday, this day, and Monday evening he was scheduled to be executed. And so in this instance, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals said, okay, we're going to stay the execution and we want the lawyers to come back and talk to us about a couple of things. They want to know whether the lawyers could have possibly found out this evidence before, if it was at all humanly possible. So, and the second thing the court is asking is whether or not this new evidence proves, by a clear and convincing standard, that Troy Davis is innocent. Doesn't just merely cast significant doubt on the conviction, but it proves that he really is innocent. A third question, which was addressed to both the prosecution and the defense, which is really interesting to me. And the third question is, even if the evidence does show that Troy Davis is guilty, if lawyers could have possibly found this information out before, can we still execute Troy Davis?
This is so perverse.
That's shocking to me. I'm very interested in reading what a team of attorneys has to say about, in the United States, why we should be executing someone who is innocent simply because the attorneys did not find out the information, the exculpatory information earlier.
Well, this is a result of Clinton's Effective Death Penalty Act of 1997, which allows innocent people to be put to death. The shocking thing is that the United States has put to death, the Innocent Project has showed well over 100 people who might have been killed but for the Innocent Project. One of the things wrong with the death penalty, only one of the things, is they kill innocent people, and they kill them in our name. This is our government doing this to us.
And the law that you just mentioned, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, it really prioritizes finality over fairness. It forces these cases through the courts very quickly. And instead of really deciding that as a society, if we're going to do something this heinous, this final, that we need to take every precaution.
I think that's right. I mean, there's all kinds of people on death row all over this country.
Michael, you've had your ear to the ground on the Guantanamo situation over all these years. What's the latest update?
There's an interesting case that's been proceeding in the military commissions. It's a man named Jawad, and he was actually one of the 2 people the U.S. acknowledges was picked up under the age of 18. In fact, he was 17, essentially a child soldier. Of course, the contradiction here is the U.S. has now signed the Child Soldier Convention, and yet they're prosecuting a child soldier in a military commission. He was apparently picked up in Afghanistan, according to the United States, and he was taken to an Afghan police station. He was threatened with death with people who had guns on them, and his family was threatened with death. And he made a statement, I guess to the effect that he'd thrown a grenade into a car with two U.S. soldiers or two Afghan soldiers. I don't recall exactly. But they eventually got him to Guantanamo. And his military commission trial, which is the criminal sort of akin to a criminal trial, is proceeding now. And one of the first motions the lawyers made was to suppress the confession on the grounds that it was the result of torture in the Afghan police station. And of course, torture under the new commission rules. Under the old commission rules, you could actually use evidence from torture. Under the new commission rules, you can't use evidence from torture, but you can use evidence from coercion, which is pretty interesting because the U.S. considers everything they've done to people to be coercion and not torture. So according to the U.S., you can use all the evidence. The lawyers, though, made the argument that threatening a person with imminent death or with death and then threatening their family was of itself torture. That you didn't need to have the so-called definition in U.S. law of prolonged mental harm. You didn't need to have physical harm. And surprisingly, and actually shockingly, the judge suppressed the so-called confession made under this threat. And what the judge said, which is an important ruling, the judge said, torture includes statements obtained by use of death threats to the speaker or his family. The actual infliction of physical or mental injury is not required. This is a pretty good definition of torture, and it's one that, of course, is going to apply to a lot more than Jawad. The next issue in Jawad's case is whether the so-called confessions made after this to U.S. authorities will be allowed in. Dahlia, we covered Jawad's military commission trial, and there's always a lot going on with Guantanamo. And in the last few days, there's been a statement by Pentagon head Gates about Guantanamo and regarding its closing. What did Gates say about it?
Gates essentially admitted that he knew that Guantanamo needed to be closed, and it needed to be closed now. However, the Bush administration is stalling until a new administration comes in.
They wouldn't listen to Gates, or they wouldn't listen to Rice. Both of those departments were for it, and their recommendations were ignored in Guantanamo.
I mean, it's very clear that there's no one's winning in Guantanamo. No one is winning in Guantanamo, and it's been a disaster all around. They want to be able to blame anything that happens after the closing of Guantanamo, on the closing of Guantanamo. They're desperate to call this a success by any measure. Yeah. And it's really disgusting.
Well, maybe if the Republicans don't steal the election, Obama will close it.
Finally. Well, you know, they both said, McCain and Obama both said that they'll close Guantanamo. But now what we really need to do is we need to pay attention to how they're closing it. And what's happening to those individuals? Is it going to be like the Algerians who are released from Guantanamo, sent back to their home country, and then disappeared? Where are those people? Are they in an underground prison somewhere halfway around the world where the world spotlight is no longer on them? That situation is no better. We've created miserable problems for all of these individuals who've been incarcerated and labeled terrorists in Guantanamo. And we need to make sure that we close Guantanamo as best as we can.
I think that's right, that it's not just a question of closing it. It's what happens to human beings who we've essentially tortured and really destroyed lives.
This story comes under the category, if you work hard and live clean, sometimes you get a break. And I saw today in the paper that Toto Constant, your nemesis, is going to do some long time for fraud. Tell us about Toto Constant and why that guy should be put in prison forever.
Well, he wasn't really my nemesis. He was the nemesis of the people of Haiti. After or during or part of the Aristide coup, first coup, Toto Constant founded an organization and was president of an organization called FRAP, which of course in French means knock, or which hit, in other words, was the Front for the Advancement of, I think, the People of Haiti or something. But it was a right-wing paramilitary organization that was accused of killing and murdering and torturing lots and lots of people. Eventually, when Aristide was restored, he fled to the United States. Before that, of course, the CIA held a press conference with him, et cetera, because they were obviously backing him. But he eventually fled to the United States, and we spent years while Aristide was still in office trying to get him deported back to Haiti. The U.S., even though they said they denied him asylum here and everything else, they refused to actually deport him back into Haiti. They essentially gave him a safe haven. But indicating that, you know, once you're sort of bad, you're bad in many different ways—
He decided to engage in mortgage fraud.
Yeah, he was living out in Queens.
Right, living out in Queens, but doing, and we couldn't get him. We sued him. We actually sued him civilly. We recovered a big judgment against him. When I say recovered, we have a judgment against him. We haven't recovered the money. We did it with another group in California called CJA. The center did it. But then he was eventually tried for mortgage fraud. And it looks like it was really a fraud. I mean, it was, I think, using fake names to get mortgages and then dump the money into some account.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe $1 million or more. And the judge gave him an extremely severe sentence, 12 to 37 years. It's hard for me to applaud such long sentences because that's really a long jail time. But it's one thing for mortgage fraud, although mortgage fraud is really serious, especially in this economic crisis. You can see how serious it is. But he also has deep, deep roots in some of the worst bloodshed in Haiti. So it is actually after how many years has it now been? 91 was the, I think, the first coup. So it's 9 plus 8, 17 years. This guy has been running around on the streets, first engaging in these conspiracies and torture and murder with FRAP, and now, of course, going to jail 12 to 37 for mortgage fraud. So we're happy to see Toto Constant off the streets. We'll see how he performs in jail.
The group Iraq Veterans Against the War, or IVAW, has emerged as the leading anti-war group in the United States. Recently, thousands of IVAW members held rallies and marches at the RNC, the Republican National Convention, and nearly 10,000 marched at the DNC, the Democratic Convention in Denver. The demonstrations urged presidential candidates to endorse ending the Iraq War and paying reparations to the people of Iraq. The IVAW also calls for the immediate withdrawal of all occupying forces in Iraq, stopping the corporate pillaging of Iraq, and full benefits, adequate health care for returning servicemen and women. IVAW chapters are in 48 states, Canada, and D.C. Members include recent veterans and active duty servicemen and women from all branches of the military services. We're joined today by Jose Vasquez, a 14-year U.S. Army veteran and conscientious objector. He is an active member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, serving as the New York City chapter president. Jose was also a key organizer of Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome, Jose, to Law and Disorder.
You were an Army member for 14 years. You've refused to serve in Iraq. You're now a leader of Iraq Veterans Against the War, instrumental in the Winter Soldier hearings. Some of your personal background, Jose. How'd you get from there to where you're at today?
Thanks, son. Thanks for having me on the show. I served active duty from 1992 to 96. I was a reconnaissance specialist, and then I served in the Army Reserve from 97 to 07. In January of 2005, I applied for conscientious objector status. I was successful. It took me about 2.5 years, but I was discharged in May of 2007. In the meantime, I met members of Iraq Veterans Against the War, started organizing with them, and I'm currently the New York City chapter president. I'm also the Winter Soldier project coordinator.
It's quite extraordinary that you were able to get CO status. What is it about your personal beliefs that you think qualified you for it?
Well, my application for conscientious objector status was pretty lengthy, but the radio version is that I practiced Buddhist meditation in my personal life, and I also just felt that the Iraq War was violating everything that I learned as a soldier. I basically grew up in the military. I signed up for the Army when I was 16, went off to basic training when I was 17. So I spent the majority of my adult life as a soldier, and I felt that as a staff sergeant, serving in Iraq would actually violate the kind of code of honor and ethics that I had learned as a soldier, and I didn't feel like we were being used in the right way.
What is going on in Iraq that you found offensive and wouldn't agree with?
Where do I begin? Boy, there's so many things that I really went through sort of a radicalization process, and more things started to get me angry. And as I educated myself about foreign policy and what was happening on the ground in Iraq, it became apparent to me that this was not something that I could participate in. And even as a medic, which was my last job in the military, I felt that I was I would be complicit in what was happening on the ground. So things like the Abu Ghraib scandal, as well as what happened in Haditha, the 2004 election, and actually something not related to the Iraq War, but the tsunami, the huge tsunami that happened at the end of 2004. That really sent me into a tailspin because I felt like there was this, you know, enormous humanitarian disaster going on. And meanwhile, we're dropping bombs on people in Iraq. And it just seemed so contradictory and so against everything that I stood for that I finally came to the point where I had to apply to get out.
Well, what happened in Haditha that you were critical of?
This happened sort of after the fact when I had applied for CO status, but that was something that also kind of made me very angry about what was happening on the ground there. So there was, for all intents and purposes, a massacre on the part of U.S. Marines in Haditha where, you know, women were raped and families were murdered in their home.
Now you're back in New York. You're the head of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Tell us about your group and what you're doing.
Sure. Like I mentioned, I'm the Winter Soldier Project Coordinator. So in addition to my duties as a chapter president, I'm responsible for promoting the book that just came out from Haymarket Books. It's called Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan, Eyewitness Accounts of the Occupations. If folks want to order that, they can go to ivaw.org and take a look at our online store. So we want to get the stories of the troops who have served on the ground, both men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as the stories of Iraqi and Afghan civilians from the perspective of people who have lived under the occupation, either carrying out the policies of the Bush administration as soldiers or as the civilians who have to live under those occupations. So we are in the process of not only promoting the book, but also rolling out different regional Winter Soldier events. We had a huge Winter Soldier event in March of this year in 2008 down at the National Labor College in Silver Spring, Maryland, where we had over 60 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans testify to atrocities that they both participated in or witnessed.
How do you account for such a extraordinarily high level of atrocities? Is this something that just goes hand in hand with war, or is there something different about Iraq? I mean, how do you explain what's happened over there?
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Robert J. Lifton. He did a lot of work on World War II and the Nazi regime during that time. He also did a lot of work and sort of therapy group sessions with Vietnam vets. And so what Robert J. Lifton calls something like the Iraq invasion is an atrocity-producing situation where you put people in a situation where they cannot distinguish between the civilian population and those that are supposed to be the enemy. And so you have, soldiers that don't speak the language. Many times, you know, young soldiers, 18, 19-year-old, walking the streets of Baghdad, doing patrols, combat patrols, and not really fully understanding what it is that they're being asked to do. And so what they are forced to do is just go into a sort of survival mode. And many times it turns out to the detriment of the civilians living on the ground.
What would be your estimate of the number of Iraqi civilian casualties since the war started?
Well, I've heard anything from as low as 30,000 to, you know, over 655,000. So the best estimates that I can give are really somewhere in that range, somewhere between, you know, I think the 30,000 is way too low. You know, people were dying in the hundreds per day at some points during the occupation. And so I feel like between civilian deaths caused not only by coalition forces, but also the quote-unquote insurgent forces in Iraq, you know, I'm no expert on exactly what the number is, but I would venture to say that the number is much closer to the 655,000 figure that was put out there. In addition, there are over 2 million internally displaced people in Iraq, as well as an additional 2 million that are outside of Iraq and the surrounding countries.
Has your membership grown in the last year or so?
Absolutely. After the Winter Soldier event, we actually had soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan, a whole squad, who said that they were watching Winter Soldier while they were in the barracks in Iraq and emailed us and said, wow, you know, what can we do from here to support the GI resistance? And so that was very encouraging to us. In addition, we had a piece that came out in Stars and Stripes in the Middle East edition. So that meant that any soldier who was reading Stars and Stripes station in the Middle East would have come across a story about Winter Soldier, and it was actually a pretty favorable story about, you know, here are what other veterans are talking about when they get back home. So we were very excited about that. And from the beginning, when we planned the event, our target audience was always military and military families. And so there were a lot of folks who said that, well, we didn't receive as much mainstream media as they had expected. We were really not disheartened by that, because we felt that our target audience, military personnel, were the folks that we wanted to reach. And after that event, actually, during that event, our membership applications just kept rolling in, and I think we've grown significantly since that time. So we're up to about 1,400 members. We have members in 49 states. We have folks in Europe, war resistors in Canada, chapters throughout the United States. So it's pretty widespread.
Your sweatshirt says, "I support Iraq veterans against the war." Do you get comments from people on the street?
Last week, as a matter of fact, I was walking in Midtown. I attend college at the CUNY Graduate Center, and a security guard or a doorman stopped me in the street, right? You know, stopped me in my tracks, and he said, "Hey, wait, let me read that shirt." And then he looked at my shirt, he looked at me, and he said, "Well, I'm an Iraq veteran against the war." So he gave me his contact information, and that's, you know, another member just on the street. And it's amazing how many people just kind of, you know, I was on my way here to the studio, folks on Wall Street were stopping and sort of taking a look, and I could sort of feel the stares of people looking at the shirt. And so I feel like a lot of people identify with it.
I just wanted to say as an aside that I was active in the anti-war movement during Vietnam. I was a lawyer in Detroit at that time, and I specialized in representing anti-war GIs. When the Winter Soldier hearings were held in Detroit, then I covered them for a small socialist newspaper. To hear you say that the broadcast of Winter Soldier was going on in the net and over to Iraq and was in the various newspapers, that's tremendous. And I really admire your good work and the good fortune of having the kind of communications that we have now as opposed to then. Let me ask you this. What is the program of Iraq Veterans Against the War? What do you stand for, and how are we going to get it?
Well, our three points of unity are immediate withdrawal of all occupying forces from Iraq, reparations for the Iraqi people, and full benefits, both physical and mental care for returning service members. We've held those points of unity since the beginning of our organization in the summer of 2004. We continue to try and get that message out there. We have not wavered on those demands. We feel like we're the only veterans organization of the recent wars that are actually calling for those types of things. I think the Winter Soldier event and sort of this model of taking soldier stories out into the communities is one of the main parts of our organizing efforts, just trying to get people to understand what's actually happening on the ground. And as you mentioned, you know, we're much more fortunate in terms of our ability to communicate with a broader audience in terms of live streaming, websites, and all of these things. And so if people want to see those stories live, stream those videos from our website, they can go to ivaw.org/Winter Soldier and see all of the testimony that was offered in March.
ivaw.org is your website.
And that's right.
ivaw.org/Winter Soldier to get the Winter Soldier hearings. And give me the name of the book again.
The name of the book from Haymarket Books is Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan, Eyewitness Accounts of the Occupations, and folks can get that on our online store at ivaw.org.
Are you hopeful that a new administration will help implement some of the demands that you're asking for?
Well, it certainly depends on who the new administration is. I feel that, you know, if McCain gets into office, McCain-Palin, we'll just see a lot more of the same. I'm a little more hopeful, although I'm registered as an independent, but I feel that an Obama-Biden administration would certainly bring some changes to what we've been seeing for the last 8 years.
On what is that hope based?
Well, I feel like McCain is somebody who's definitely using his veteran status in a lot of ways to try and win this. But I feel that his record demonstrates that from the perspective of veterans, he's voted over and over again not to support the veterans that are coming home. And he even voted against the new GI Bill, which is astounding to me, to actually kind of modernize the GI Bill from World War II. He, as a veteran, should understand how important that was and how fundamental that was in transforming American society from the 50s. 1950s onward, all of these troops came home, started going to college, started buying homes, and really were kind of the foundation following that war. And I feel like anybody who votes against the new GI Bill really does not support the troops. You know, they might say one thing, but they do the other.
But Jose, what's been very disappointing to me is that neither candidate has said the war was based on a lie. There were never any weapons of mass destruction. The Bush administration knew it at the time they were perpetrating that lie. There was never any connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. They knew it at the time they were perpetrating that lie. There's a different reason for going into Iraq. It's been an utter disaster. They've destroyed a civilization. They've destroyed the American soldiers who they put in that position. And we should get out now. And none of them are saying that. In fact, they're not even having a discussion about it. They're kind of reshuffling the chairs. Maybe we'll get out partially in 16 months, but only if we send more troops to Afghanistan. Then we got to think about Pakistan also. And it hasn't been on the part of either party, in my opinion, any kind of discussion that would educate the American people or mobilize them or even give us any kind of hope that they'd get the troops out in any time in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think you're right. In terms of the issue of the war, the debate is so limited in terms of what people are saying, and certainly all of the things that you pointed out, nobody's saying that they want the troops out immediately. And even Obama is basically saying that he wants to continue the war on terror and just refocus things on Afghanistan. And so, in fact, we're, having a discussion within IVAW about what are the implications of an Obama administration for our organization, because we're, so focused on the Iraq war. What is it going to mean for the next, 4 to 8 years? If, in fact, troops are, combat brigades are moved from Iraq into Afghanistan, certainly we want to foment as much resistance in Afghanistan as we do in Iraq. And so there's a big discussion actually going on within our organization. And I'm sure other organizations are also kind of taking stock in terms of what that would actually look like for an anti-war movement. For many years, the Afghanistan war was considered the good war, and that, people didn't have, certainly not among your listeners, but the Afghanistan was okay because it was connected to 9/11, and that Iraq was the illegal war, the bad war. But I think people are really starting to rethink that. And in fact, for the last few months, more troops have died in Afghanistan than in Iraq. And so we really need to think about the war on terror in general, in the big picture.
Jose Vasquez, you're the head of Iraq Veterans Against the War here in New York State. We're very proud to have you on Law and Disorder. Give us again your website, the name of your book, so that our listeners can get in touch with you and read what you're working on.
Folks can go to Iraq Veterans Against the War's website at ivaw.org. If they want to order the book, which is called Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan, Eyewitness Accounts of the Occupations, also go to our website, ivaw.org, and check out the online store. All the proceeds of that go towards the organization, so you help our organizing efforts by purchasing it from us and not Amazon.com or something like that.
Jose Vasquez, head of IVAW, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Great. It's my pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Nearly 4,200 U.S. soldiers and 1 million Iraqi civilians have been killed in the U.S. occupation of Iraq since 2003. Right now, there are 75 major U.S. bases in Iraq, 140,000 U.S. troops, and 180,000 private contractors operating in Iraq.
The cost of the war so far is $3 trillion, and this year, the monthly average expense is $12 billion. Now, a pact, negotiated in secret by the U.S. government, intends to extend the U.S. occupation 3 more years in Iraq, despite public and congressional opposition. Tens of thousands of Iraqis have demonstrated against the pact that calls for full U.S. withdrawal by 2012. But the agreement also leaves open the possible later date of withdrawal. We're joined today by editor and writer Anthony Arnove, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. His latest project is Voices of a People's History.
Anthony Arnove, we're really glad to have you back at Law and Disorder. And we want to talk again with you about Iraq. First, you should at least mention what your book is again.
Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, an updated edition out from Metropolitan Books and the American Empire Project series.
Right, and as I recall, Howard Zinn wrote both the preface as well as the conclusion.
And the title is taken from a book that Howard wrote in the late 1960s called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal, making an argument, which at that time was not a very popular argument, for immediate withdrawal from Vietnam.
Here we are a few days before the election, and thinking about Iraq, and of course what's been in the papers lately primarily has been the negotiation of the Status of Forces Agreement. That's one of the things we'd like to talk to you about, and whatever the resistance is within some segments of the Iraqi government or people. Why don't you bring us up to date on how you see what's going on that agreement?
The U.S. occupation was what I would consider being an illegal occupation, an illegal invasion, based on utterly false pretenses. But as soon as it took place and was declared a fait accompli by the Bush administration, you saw the United Nations come in and give it legitimacy by passing a number of resolutions that governed the presence of the United States in Iraq. The interesting thing that's now happening is that the latest UN resolution covering the U.S. occupation expires on the 31st of December this year. And the United States faces a situation where that agreement is not likely to be renewed. So they're looking for a direct agreement between themselves and a government which they put in power to govern the ongoing presence of the United States as an occupying power into 2009 and beyond. And that's what's being referred to as the Status of Forces Agreement.
If they don't sign a Status of Forces Agreement by December 31st and the UN mandate expires, what happens?
Well, at that point, the United States is an illegal foreign occupying power. Barring an agreement with the United Nations, they would be staying in violation of international law.
Right. Well, what do you think is likely? Because they could go back to the UN, or they might try and actually just push this agreement through.
I think that they're much more likely to push this agreement through, and because of the imbalance of power between the United States and the Iraqi government, which is now, you see, creating tension between Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister, the party that he's from, the Dawah party, the Iraqi parliament, which is dominated by a coalition that dominated by the Dawah party and other Shia groups that are relatively accommodationist to the U.S. occupation. You see a negotiation taking place. I think the United States is going to be able to get something in place that's going to allow them to continue the occupation. Now, it looks like it's going to be a less favorable agreement than the United States was hoping for. I'll outline some of the areas where there's tension. The United States currently is responsible for the detention of thousands of Iraqis who are being held without trial, without access to lawyers. Some of them have been held for several years in really repressive conditions. There's a question of what's going to happen to those detainees under this new agreement.
Those are detainees in U.S. custody, is that right?
Absolutely.
And they're going to be transferred into Iraqi custody, supposedly, but apparently that's a disaster also, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we've seen horrific abuses of Iraqi detainees who are being held under command and control of the Iraqi government and Iraqi security forces, just as we've seen abuses under U.S. control, of course. But there's also a broader question here, which is, who has the right to detain people at all? right now, the United States claims very broad powers to detain people that it considers a security threat without any due process whatsoever being afforded to them. They want to be able to continue to detain people, hold people, without having to get the approval of Iraqi authorities. So that's one area of contention. Another area of contention is what happens in situations where U.S. soldiers or mercenaries, let's not forget that the U.S. occupation still involves a heavy presence of security contractors from companies like Blackwater, DynCorp, Triple Canopy, etc. What kind of provisions are there for dealing with abuses of Iraqi civil rights, human rights, by those forces under the new Status of Forces Agreement? The United States wants impunity from Iraqi law for U.S. forces. They also would like it for the contractors, for the mercenaries, seeming like they won't be able to get full immunity for the contractors, and that there's going to be some compromise on immunity for the forces having to do with whether they're on duty or off duty at the time of any crime that they commit.
Anthony, what about the other tensions, like the bases the United States wants and the oil that they always wanted, and just the projection of power in that area of the world? What's happening with respect to those things?
Yeah, that's a very important question, Michael. The U.S. Has 14 bases right now in Iraq that are serious structures that are really what in any reasonable term you would call permanent bases, or at the very least enduring bases. Now, the U.S. claims that they have no permanent bases in Iraq. In reality, they have no permanent bases anywhere in the world, but they have bases that they occupy and station troops and use as a base for projecting power far into the future. And there's a number of facilities in Iraq that meet that criteria. You also have in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, the largest embassy, not only of the United States, but of any government anywhere in the world. You also have the largest foreign CIA station in Baghdad.
Wow.
So the CIA has no larger foreign presence than it does right now in Baghdad. So they're clearly making plans to stay for many years to come. And the deal is likely to provide some mechanism, I think, for those bases to continue. The question will be, what kind of operations can be mounted from those bases? What kind of immunity is there for troops when they engage in conduct on those bases? Will they be subject to Iraqi law? And what really the United States is trying to do is carve out a whole separate area.
When we talk about withdrawal, we're not talking about withdrawal of all of what you've just said, the CIA, these 14 so-called non-permanent bases.
Absolutely
but,
not.
But there is something in the agreement about withdrawal. What is that?
The withdrawal language, this is a real Orwellian sleight of hand. Obama, McCain, Maliki, President Bush, everyone's involved in a sleight of hand here. The language that's being used is withdrawal of combat troops on a timetable that's flexible. Conditions on the ground could affect it, it could change. But roughly the idea is that on some timetable that could be adjusted by 2010, 2011, 2012, the dates are being negotiated, there could be a withdrawal of combat troops. Now, combat troops only comprise about half of the U.S. occupation. Because there's a whole number of U.S. military forces that aren't technically classified as combat troops, including U.S. forces. Then, of course, there are the mercenaries, the private contractors that don't fall into that category. So if you look at the provisions for the kinds of troops that can stay in Iraq, there are the mercenaries, and there's an acknowledgement, even from one of Barack Obama's top foreign policy advisors who gave an interview to Jeremy Scahill, the author of the book Blackwater and a reporter for The Nation. He gave an interview to Jeremy in which he said, we might actually need to send more mercenaries, more contractors to Iraq to make up for some of the combat troops that we're redeploying. Now, and note that also they're not talking about pulling them out of Iraq and bringing them home. They're talking about shifting them to Afghanistan. They're talking about shifting them to over-the-horizon, so-called, other military bases in the region where they could be part of a rapid reaction force that could quickly move back into Iraq. So there's those forces. Then there are forces that are engaged in so-called counterinsurgency operations, and there's provisions for them remaining in Iraq. Well, counterinsurgency is the rationale that the Bush administration gives for continuing the occupation. So that's not a laughing matter. That's a very serious rationale for continuing troops to remain in Iraq for years to come. Then there's provisions for leaving troops to engage in training operations. The idea that, as George Bush puts it, we'll stand down as the Iraqis stand up. As long as no Iraqi security forces are going to have any legitimacy. They're going to be seen as agents of an unwanted foreign occupation.
And what about the question of oil? You remember initially when they invaded Iraq, they called it Operation Iraqi Liberation. And then when they realized it was the acronym for oil, they changed it. That was one of their purposes, oil. And do the agreements have anything to say about that?
Well, there's a whole series of negotiations that are taking place now around Iraqi oil. It's important to underline the fact that Iraq has the world's second or third largest reserves of oil. Its resources are vastly underexploited. It's very important because there's very little reserve capacity in the world oil system, oil production system at the moment. Iraq is a country that, if you were able to bring its oil fully online, do more exploration, invest in its infrastructure, you could be potentially talking significant amounts of oil that would alter the balance of power on the world oil markets. And, of course, from the very beginning, that was a primary motivation for the United States, was to gain control over Iraqi oil, but not just Iraqi oil, to use Iraq as a base for the projection of power in a region that has two-thirds of world oil reserves and most of the world's natural gas as well, on top of the fact that they also have the world's most strategic shipping routes for all of this energy. So the U.S. is in negotiations and basically is trying to make as a condition for any agreements with the Iraqi government that they pass a national oil law, and that the national oil law, the language is basically written by free market fantasists about a neoliberal dream of what Iraq should look like. There would be very little restriction on foreign control. There would be very little restriction on the ability of foreign companies to expatriate profits from Iraq. And in effect, it would be signing over Iraq's oil industry to Western corporations allied to the United States and to other countries that were part of the initial invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003. And we see moves towards that. There's also some tension because Iraq's oil is distributed around the country very unequally. So this is leading to some regional tensions between regions like the northern Kurdish part of the country, the southern primarily Shia part of the country, and the central government over exactly how these decisions will be made. We've seen regional governments entering into direct negotiations to exploit and sell off their oil. This is leading to a lack of a coherent national program, and that's something that the United States is going to continue to fight for so that there's a stable investment climate for Western oil companies.
Anthony Arnov, author of The Logic of Withdrawal, recently been updated, an excellent book that we recommend to our listeners. Let me ask you this question. What is your assessment of what the foreign policy with respect to Iraq would be if Obama gets elected? And follow-up question would be, what should the anti-war movement be doing?
I think we're in a situation where most people think that Barack Obama's position is different than what it is, than his actual stated position. Most people think Barack Obama is against the war. He wants to end it. He wants to end it quickly. He'll have all the troops out in 18 months. But as we were discussing earlier, that's not the reality of the situation. He's said that 18-month timetable is contingent on the advice of military advisors. Well, these are military advisors like, you know, Gates, the Secretary of Defense, who he actually may keep on as the Pentagon chief. He's been very seriously considering that option, who are against pulling all the troops out. He's also said it depends on conditions on the ground. So any uptick of violence or instability in Iraq could be a rationale for continuing the occupation longer. And again, that timetable that he's talking about is only for combat troops. It's not for the bases. It's not for the embassy. It's not for the CIA Station Bureau. It's not for the troops that are involved in counterinsurgency or that are involved in force protection or training operations. So I think very realistically, you're going to see U.S. occupation of Iraq continuing throughout an Obama administration.
Let me ask you a question about this, Anthony, because I just got an email from someone I won't say, but they said, oh, go to Obama's website, and it says that two things. It says, one, any agreement with the Iraqi status of forces has to be subjected to congressional approval. He doesn't want the president doing this on his own. And everybody says, oh, see, Obama's being more democratic here. And the second part of that website posting is apparently that he doesn't want any permanent bases in Iraq. In a sense, you've already answered the second part. But so they're sort of beginning to laud Obama out there. What do you say to that?
Well, the permanent bases is a ruse. If he says tomorrow we're going to remove all the troops and remove all the bases, that would be one thing. But permanent is meaningless in this debate because George Bush has said he's against permanent bases. I don't take that seriously. That's just rhetoric. On the point of congressional approval of the Status of Forces Agreement, what's really going on here is that, A, Barack Obama is asserting his authority. He's going to become heir of U.S. foreign policy in Iraq, and he wants as much as possible to enter into negotiations on his own terms, not having to deal with agreements that Bush puts into place. So there's actually very little difference between the positions of McCain and Bush and Obama at this point. There's a convergence, really, on a set of ideas over how to best manage the occupation that has emerged over the last year, with Obama saying the surge worked beyond our wildest expectations, as you saw him say on Bill O'Reilly's program on Fox TV. McCain saying, yes, we do need to have some kind of timetable for withdrawal, and maybe we do need to be putting more of an emphasis on Afghanistan, which is a page he's taking from Obama. So it's kind of a convergence, a new consensus emerging around Afghanistan and how to manage the occupation and how to deflect the anti-war movement, which is...
Do you see some accountability happening for crimes of private military security contractors? So, for example, cases of abuse have been referred to the DOJ, but they're just sitting there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very skeptical that there's going to be any accountability for the government officials or the mercenaries.
How much money is in the private military security contracting business? How much money have tax dollars sent that way?
Billions of dollars. And what we've seen is that no matter how much abuse is exposed in terms of people siphoning off money, people taking money for projects that are never executed, people overbilling, people engaging in, you know, the kinds of abuses that we saw with the murders of Iraqis in Firdaus Square last September that were clearly, all the investigations have shown, were completely unjustified killings, there's been total impunity. And, of course, there's impunity for the government officials who are signing off on these deals and who are making the decisions that are sending these mercenaries into Iraq. And I really
That's one area in this economic crisis that they're doing quite well, thanks to our tax dollars.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a booming industry.
People think that we're sending these folks over that are experts in Iraq, that are appropriate in whose ever mind to be there. But really, if you meet some of these people, you get a sense that they're somebody you pulled out of a frat house, and 10 years later, they're getting these enormous contracts.
We should also point out that they're expanding their operations. So right now, Blackwater is getting money to expand its operations as part of the so-called war on drugs in Latin America, particularly focused in Colombia. You are likely to see more military contractors going into Afghanistan as part of the escalation that you see happening there with the support of Barack Obama. And, of course, once you start talking about intervention in Afghanistan, you're raising the likelihood of more intervention in Pakistan as well. So I think this is a really ongoing and pressing issue, and we need to make sure people understand this is not just about George Bush. This is not just about the Republican Party. As horrible as the last 8 years have been, there's much more bipartisan support for these policies, and there's much more continuity than most people acknowledge.
If you had one central thought now that we're on the eve of the election to share with our audience, Anthony Arnov, what would that be?
When we grow up in this country, we're taught that, you know, the most important thing you can do is vote. And that, you know, once every 4 years, you get to have your say, and that's your civic responsibility, and that's how you participate in this democracy. And what that idea basically reinforces is the idea that democracy is a spectator sport, and that you participate in it once every 4 years, and that basically you're limited to participating and choosing between this or that candidate of the establishment who's been chosen through a process of unbelievable influence peddling and weeding out of any candidate that might be a threat to the establishment. And really, it leads to this completely impoverished idea of what politics is and what political participation is and what democracy is. For me, the most important day in this coming period is not November 4th. The most important day is January 20th or November 5th, depending on how you want to look at it. It's all the other days of the year when we're not allowed to vote, when we don't get to have a say, and we have to find a way to have a say by participating in social movements, participating in organizations, participating in protest, making our voices heard every single day. If you are a soldier who served in Iraq or Afghanistan, there's a role that you can play in an organization like Iraq Veterans Against War that I can't. You know, I can support IVAW. I can encourage people who are in the military to find out about IVAW. If you're a student, there's groups like Campus Anti-War Network. If you're a veteran, there's groups like Veterans for Peace. If you're someone in the military in your family, there's the Military Families Organizing Against the War. If you're in a community that's being targeted for recruitment, there's counter-recruitment work you can do. There's no one-size-fits-all answer other than that you can't do it alone, that as an individual we have very little power, but as a movement in organizations working with other people, you can have a tremendous power. That's the history of this country, is that when ordinary people have come together in movements, in organizations, outside of the narrow channels that we're told constitute politics, like showing up and pulling a lever on election day, that's how real change has come about. That's how the Vietnam War ended. That's how women won the right to vote. That's how we ended slavery, you know. And that takes long, difficult work of building those movements, building those organizations. And there's no shortcut to doing it.
Well said, Anthony Arnov, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. Thank you very much, Anthony, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Anthony. It's great to have you again.
Nice to talk to you, Anthony. Thanks.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.